Can I move that?
Present for the record are Representatives Cott, Guerra, Anderson, Coghill, and myself, McGuire. We do have a quorum to conduct business. First on the agenda is Senate Bill number 135 by Senator Dyson. And his staff is here. And I don't have anybody online, so I'm hoping you can tell us about it. And 135.
Madam Chair. Jason Hooley, staff to Senator Dyson. The contents of Senate Bill 135 brought to us by the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. Who's available to answer questions as well. The bill is in response to a couple of court cases from our Court of Appeals in which those responsible for harming children escaped full responsibility for doing so. And the bill deals with two crimes, assault and custodial interference. Regarding assault, currently it's third-degree assault if an adult recklessly harms a child under 10 and that harm reasonably requires medical attention. And the bill modifies that provision to include reckless harm that, quote, causes a reasonable caregiver to seek medical attention from a health care professional in the form of diagnosis or treatment. Secondly, Madam Chair, regarding custodial interference, if a non-custodial parent takes or holds a child without the proper permission or authority and claims that doing so was necessary to prevent abuse and neglect, the bill limits that defense of necessity to 24 hours or the time it takes to contact authorities, whichever is shorter. That's all.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Hooley? Representative Guerra.
Madam Chair, thanks very much. I don't understand the difference between on Section 2. The first part seems fine and a good, responsible change in the law. The second part, I honestly don't know the difference between what the law is right now and what how the proposal changes the law. If you could help me with that.
I'll try to.
Dean Guinelli's right behind you.
Oh, good. I'll take
Mr. Guinelli?
Yeah, what else?
So this is the necessity part.
Thank you. For the record, Dean Guinelli with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. Again, through the chair, Representative Garrett, the question was on what part of Section 2?
Section 2, yeah. Just tell me what the affirmative defense of necessity is in a custodial interference case now and then how it's being changed.
through the chair, it's our view that that there really is no affirmative defense of necessity in a custodial interference case. The courts have held that over a number of years, and what just recently happened is the Alaska Court of Appeals, in effect, created a form of affirmative defense of necessity when you take your child and then later claim that you were taking your child because you thought the child was being abused by the custodial parent. I mean, maybe the best example is to give you the facts in which this case arose. There was a man who actually sued for custody of his child. The Superior Court disagreed and gave the custody to the mother, but the father had visitation rights. The father complained to the state troopers, complained to the Department of Health and Social Services, the child is being neglected, but had no evidence of that. Even though he had visitation, he had no evidence of that. Most likely it was just an attempt to get custody of the child. Ultimately, after one visitation period, he didn't return the child and left the state. Went first to California. Went to Ohio, went to Oklahoma, changing his appearance, changing his name, you know, hiding from authorities the entire time. He was gone for over 3 months before he finally got caught, and then what he wanted to argue to the jury and what the Court of Appeals ultimately allowed him to do is to say, I took my child and I held my child only because I felt that the child was being neglected. In our view, that's not really what the state policy ought to be. I mean, if you want to go to authorities, that's one thing. If you want to go back to court and litigate custody, that's something else. But to take the law in your own hand to keep the child away for many months and then be able to play on the sympathies of a jury saying that you did it for good reasons is not something that that should be tolerated. So what this provision does is it says if you hold your child past your visitation period, you can only do it for a maximum of 24 hours or the time it takes you to communicate with law enforcement authorities or social service authorities if you believe your child is in danger. And it then puts the onus on the person. If you really are concerned about your child's health and welfare, talk to the proper authorities and let them deal with it or go back to court. It prevents people from taking the law in their own hands. And that's what it does.
Representative Kerr? Let me just so people know, there's something called the necessity defense in the law. It says that if you commit a crime, but the reason for committing the crime was to prevent something that was even worse, then you have something called the necessity defense. So the exact circumstance Mr. Guarnelli mentioned is what the law is. In this kind of case, you would, if you felt the child were being physically, let's say, physically threatened by the custodial parent, let's just assume you were right about that, and you take the child away to protect the child. That's a defense right now. I guess my question about this amendment is, so you're saying you can't have a necessity defense. You take the child away from an abusive situation, and you lose your necessity defense if you don't return the child to the abuser in the shorter of 24 hours or the time it takes you to call a social service agency. So you call a social service agency, they say they'll get back to you on Monday. More than 24 hours has elapsed, and you haven't given the child back to the abuser. I mean, it doesn't seem to be a good policy unless juries are abusing the necessity defense. And I can't, the necessity defense is so hard to prove in front of a jury. I can't believe that, I don't want to sit here and assume that the jury's going to be that stupid to let somebody get away with a necessity defense if it's really not warranted.
Madam Chair, Representative Guerra, I think the policy really is whether whether these kinds of allegations, and in this case there were allegations of this sort made, and there was just simply no evidence of it. The person took the law in his own hands and was gone for 3 months. The question, though, is seems to me the policy is whether we are going to turn a criminal trial into a relitigation of all the matters that have already been decided in the context of a child custody matter. I mean, these are emotional proceedings. Both sides have very hard feelings. Accusations fly back and forth, and the proper forum for that is the children's court in front of a judge's experience. It's not going in front of six or twelve jurors and trying to relitigate that in the context of a criminal defense criminal case. And that's simply what this provides. I mean, frankly, if there's evidence of abuse or neglect, a peace officer or social service agency is going to take action. Maybe that's not your experience.
With all due respect, I have an article from the Daily News I used yesterday that said 40% of all child abuse cases have been sitting at the Anchorage Police Department for close to a year. That was as of 2 years ago, and I'm sure the numbers have changed. But I'm concerned still that this whole idea is that it becomes a crime if you take a kid away from an abusive situation and nobody responds to do something about it. We're talking about a really rare circumstance, but did the jury come up with the wrong...
Well, the person was convicted. The person was not allowed to present the evidence to the jury. The person was convicted, and the Court of Appeals said you should have been allowed to present all this evidence to the jury. So I ultimately don't know what happened to the case after that. I think it's a matter of what state policy ought to be and whether child custody matters ought to be litigated in children's court or in a criminal court. And I think it ought to be in children's court.
Representative Anderson and then Grover.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Guerra, would you be amenable to changing it to 48 hours to kind of bypass that the weekend rule? Where someone's like, it's Saturday. I mean, I don't really want to call the cops, but I want to call social services, but they're not open. I can do it Monday, though. Oh, wait, the legislature passed a law that says...
I think something along that lines. I think what you want is for them to report this case and not take the law into their own hands. Certainly that's the point of the bill. But the 24-hour thing is a little bit arbitrary. I'd be more comfortable to say you lose the necessity defense if you don't report the case to a peace officer or a social service agency within a reasonably necessary amount of time. So, but the 24-hour thing just seems arbitrary.
Madam Chair, I mean, it seems to me that the whole question becomes what's reasonably necessary and to someone who has already reported to the state troopers and the Department of Health and Social Services and they didn't find any evidence of this, for them, the reasonably necessary thing to do is to leave Alaska and go to another state, go to the second state and go to a third state, I mean, which is exactly what this person did. And there may be one person on the jury who finds that a reasonable doubt as to whether that was reasonably necessary. And then where are we? I mean, we're basically allowing someone to have taken the child away from the custodial parent. I have one of my many duties is handling extradition matters for the governor, reviewing extradition requests. I can't tell you how many custodial parents have called me saying, isn't there something the state can do? You know, my child was taken, she's gone, I haven't seen her for 3 months. I hear that my husband's in this state or that state. It's really heartbreaking to tell those people there really is nothing that can be done until they are found. And then later when the child is found to prosecute that person and have it brought up in court that, you know, there's this allegation or that allegation that no one thought there was any evidence of before. I think that's really a shame, and I think it really denies the custodial rights of people who were legitimately given those rights by the Superior Court. And I just don't think that should be allowed to happen. I thought this was a reasonable accommodation. It's a little bit like what the requirement that the courts have for escape from prison. I mean, if you allege that you were being brutalized in prison, the courts have recognized, okay, there's a necessity defense for escape. It may be necessary to prevent a greater harm, but you just can't keep running. You've got to turn yourself in immediately and report that to authorities. I mean, you just can't leave prison and be gone and think that you're going to get away with it. This is along the same lines. Requires immediately going to someone who's in a position to do something about it.
Representative Gruenberg, you want to yield?
Yes, sure. And then I'll do my stuff after.
Representative
Garrett? Let me just finish this, and I'm sorry, it's the end of session,
sure,
and I'm
no,
out of patience with a lot of things. But please don't tell us that the necessity defense is an easy thing to use. The courts require a specifically high burden before they'll ever let you use the necessity defense. You can't just allege it, and you might want to explain to the committee what the extra burden is before you're allowed to use the necessity defense. I'm sorry, I just don't buy it that your fear that somebody could take a kid out of the state for 30 days or 3 months before calling a peace officer, and your fear that a jury would think that's a reasonable time, I don't have that fear. I don't think people are that dumb. So I think you say, look, you can only use the necessity defense if you're trying to prevent a greater harm. That's when the necessity defense is there. And you have to, and you can only use it if you report it to a peace officer or a social service agency in the necessary time or reasonably necessary time. I don't think that juries are going to be snowed under by sort of bogus claims in this regard. But 24 hours is just completely arbitrary.
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Have we, in some manner, dealt with this issue before in the last couple of years? Has there been another bill on this or anything? Or is it just that I read the case? Maybe I just read the case.
The Chair, I'm not aware.
Okay. Okay. Of course, I practice in this area and have, not practicing now, but I did. And I have had people who have taken children and never returned them. I've had people take children and murder the children and kill themselves. I mean, this is serious stuff. The 24-hour situation may be a bit arbitrary, but at least in this state and most other states that I'm aware of, there's the availability of domestic violence orders. And you can go down and get an ex parte domestic violence protective order giving you emergency custody of that child. And all you have to, and that's available 24 hours a day, at least in most locations that I'm aware of, is through the chair. Isn't that true, Mr. Gonnelli?
Through the chair, that is correct.
I mean, here we have a situation that if a person is concerned about the safety of the child, all they have to do is contact a police officer, and the police are always available, or the troopers are always available, or they can go and get a DV order, and they can go down to the courthouse, and I think most people are aware of that, and just, ring the bell, and Brock Schamberger, one of the magistrates, will give you the forms, and you fill them out. If you say that the person is a valid defense if they get a 48-hour head start, that may make it absolutely impossible to find that person. I once had a case, not to tell a war story, but I will, where I learned that a person was on the plane to Seattle with the child. I called Judge Carlson, got an order, and we had the Port of Seattle police meet that plane. This is serious, and other cases where that hasn't happened, and they've never been found, at least until they were adults and came back. Sometimes they never came back. So I would hope that we don't have this amendment.
Okay. Is there anybody else here in the audience that wishes to testify on Senate Bill number 135? Is there anybody online? Okay, so public testimony is closed. That brings the bill back before us. Representative Guerra, did you?
Sure. I'm going to offer one amendment. I'm just going to explain it, and then we won't talk about it after the amendment's done and before we pass the bill out. Sometimes the courts make a mistake in deciding which parent to give custody to. The circumstance in this bill is pretty rare, but we deal with rare things on this committee. The circumstance in this bill, the question that arises is, if the court ends up giving the child to the abusive parent, and sometimes you have a bad choice between parents, unfortunately, and that's what happens when you have family dysfunction, and those are the families that end up having, sometimes, those are the families that end up having custody fights. You have a dysfunctional family, the wrong parent gets the child, the parent is abusing the child, the parent that doesn't have custody, or somebody else in the family, anybody else in the family, or any neighbor says, I'm taking this kid away, and they freak out for a little bit, and they take maybe 2 or 3 days to call a social service agency or a police officer. That shouldn't be a crime. So this whole 24-hour thing, I think, is arbitrary. I think juries will see through a BS defense. I don't think that people will help parents steal children in the state. So I think I'm very comfortable with, I'm going to move amendment number one, which is a conceptual amendment, which will be to delete line 18 on page 2 and have the bill say, it's conceptual, and just make the standard the time reasonably necessary and then continue the rest of the language.
Also, Madam Chair, this is a new gavel for this.
So there's an objection.
A new gavel.
There's an objection to the amendment. Do you want to speak to your objection?
I would just say that it was nice to listen, as the committee often brings out debate and dialogue, listen to Representative Garrett's rationale behind it. I was encouraged when his eyes lighted up and he said, 24 hours and the weekend thing bothers me. But then he said, the amendment, which is, just at a not a time specific, and then it led me back to the compelling argument of Representative Gruenberg, and I think I would have to reject the amendment and keep 24 hours based on his, when you're talking about murder in certain circumstances, that's compelling enough to me to say Dean was right, but it's a close call.
Okay, further discussion on amendment number one? Okay, Madam Secretary, will you call the roll on conceptual amendment one?
Representative McGuire.
No.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Representative Cochran?
No.
Representative Cott? Is not here. Representative Dawson?
No.
Representative Gruber?
No.
Representative Garrett?
Yes.
One yes.
Oh, Representative Cott returned. I don't know if you know.
So amendment number one fails to carry. I guess what I want to say on the record, Mr. Gunelli, is, you know, we lose track of a lot of the things that we pass in this committee, but I would be interested to have, I guess, an update or some kind of a communication with this committee next year, to the extent that and about how this has played out. I understand Representative Guerra's concerns, and I know of cases where the court has not made the proper custodial decision. Sometimes it's a matter of one parent having more money and being able to hire a better lawyer, or the court not having all the information. But I'm more swayed by Representative Gruenberg's concerns, but I think it's a very delicate balance. So if this doesn't work, and if there are places where we see juries, I guess, putting people in jail for things that really are reasonable, then I'd like to know about it. So, Representative Gruenberg.
I pulled out the Perrin case. It's a very interesting case. It's a court of appeals with three judges. Judge Stewart wrote the decision, Judge Coates wrote a concurring opinion, Judge Mannheimer wrote a lengthy dissent, and I obviously haven't had a chance to read the whole thing. I'm going to have my staff duplicate the case. Does anybody else want a copy of it? Are you raising your hand? Oh, okay.
You could give it to Vanessa.
Carol, if you would do this. It's worth reading, I think.
Representative
Sets out everything.
Further discussion? Representative Guerra?
Chair, and I won't require a vote on this, only if people think it's a good idea and you can nod. It's the bill says the shorter of. What about the shorter of 72 hours or the time necessary? If the time necessary is less than 72 hours, then that's the standard. If it's a weekend and it's Monday before you get to call social services, remember this defense, you still have to prove that you needed to take the child away to save the child from harm. You don't get to use the defense unless you prove that. So if folks are interested in making it 72 hours instead of 24, the shorter of 72 or the time necessary, that would work too.
Representative Gruenberg?
I'm sorry to be taking the opposite side on you. But the litigation with this bill, even as it's written, will be what time was, quote, necessary. And the parent's going to be fleeing down the Alcan or skipping from plane to plane and saying, I couldn't call because I was in the air, I couldn't call because I didn't have enough time at the airport. And they have a bright line here with a certain amount of time. I think as a practical matter, in many cases, and Mr. Gunelli, correct me if I'm wrong, the easier thing will be to say, hey, more than 24 hours elapsed. And that's just a bright line kind of a thing. And if we extend it to 72 hours as a practical matter, that's what's going to be used a lot. Otherwise, we're going to have very lengthy trials. Well, I can't say very lengthy, but it'll be more convoluted and more difficult and probably take more time. So I would not.
I agree with Professor Gruenberg.
I'm done, Madam Chair. I guess I would be shocked, and I wish I was able to bet on this job, but I would be quite shocked if the Department of Law for the first time in Alaska history came here next year to tell us it did become too easy to convict somebody. So your request was, if people end up in jail too easily, come back and tell us. I've never heard them say that before. It would be great to hear someday, but I'm not holding my breath.
Representative Gruenberg.
Hey, Mr. Gunelli, maybe I can ask you. These custodial interference cases are difficult to find the people quite often. How many of these does the state prosecute a year?
Through the chair, it's a small number, Representative Gruenberg.
Less than 20?
Yeah, I would say less than 20. And you're right, it is difficult to. People often never return. I remember one case because it was over here in Juneau Superior Court when someone who had taken, a husband had taken four young children, left Alaska, left the country, went to Australia. By the time he returned to the United States and was arrested down south, the children were all grown, and the mother, you know, I mean, I remember seeing her in court, and she's saying, "I've lost my children. I mean, he has completely turned them against me. They're all adults now, and they've been hearing for the last dozen years of their life is how terrible I was and how I abandoned them." And I mean, it was heartbreaking, and I think that. You know, I certainly respect Representative Guerra's views, and I've got to say, I mean, we encounter lots of situations that I think we could prosecute as custodial interference, and we take a careful look at them. And if there, you know, if there's some reasonable explanation for why the child was held too long, I mean, you, for one thing or another, couldn't get it back in time, or there was something. I mean, those are cases that a jury is not going to convict on, has no jury appeal, and we have no interest in doing that. But I guess the question is, I think what our fear is that the situation, it's not that someone is going to be unjustly convicted, because I frankly have faith in our discretion to take prosecute proper cases, but that someone who really was doing it for the wrong reason is going to be unjustly acquitted, or there's going to be a hung jury, and it's just going to draw out the proceedings time and time again. And that's what we're trying to avoid.
Madam Chair, through the chair, I'm more interested in focusing really on pretrial. Is there anything that we can do as a legislator to help locate these people?
Groombrook, I don't mean to do this, but it is 2:10. I've asked for latitude from the speaker so we can get to workers' comp, but I would like to continue that dialogue. Okay, so Representative Anderson.
I move Senate Bill 135 out of committee with individual recommendations and attached procedural fiscal notes.
Okay, is there any objection to that motion? Okay, hearing none, Senate Bill number 135 has moved. That brings us to Senate Bill number 130. And we'll take a brief at ease. Here in the House Judiciary Committee, it is 2:12. We have Senate Bill number 130 before us. Is there any further committee discussion?
Here.
Representative Cott.
I object yesterday to moving the bill out of committee because I had some concerns over the second injury fund number one. And over the course of the evening, I was hoping to acquire some information on that, and it still seems to be somewhat confusing as to whether or not the second injury fund is working or not. My sense is that we should err on the side of conservatism. I think at this point we should leave the second injury fund as is in the bill as it was put in yesterday. I think Representative Coghill thought of the same. There may be some other impacts from a judicial standpoint, so I think at this point, between now and whenever this bill reaches us on the floor for a vote, there'll still be sufficient time. But I believe at this point that we should leave that second injury fund in the bill, in spite of what Mr. Kavanaugh said, that it's not working. So I haven't been convinced one way or the other that it is or is not working. I know it is somewhat of a cost driver. We couldn't get the numbers from the Division of Insurance, what it was costing employers keeping in. I still believe there is a tail on some of those cases. I'm a little concerned that those injured workers may not get what is ultimately due to them. So having said that, Madam Chair, in some assurance that some of my other concerns are being met, I'm willing to move this bill out of committee.
So it's moving on to the Finance Committee, and obviously we'll keep track of it. So is there a motion, Representative Carr? Do you want to make a motion?
Madam Chair, then I'd move House Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 130, Labor and Commerce Audit Committee with individual recommendations in the fiscal note.
Okay, is there an objection to that motion? Okay, hearing none, the House CS for CS for Senate Bill number 130 has moved on to the Finance Committee. Okay, we have 15 more minutes, so what I want to do is start SB 132. I've been told by our Rules Chairman that this is a priority bill, and it's up on the floor tomorrow. So if we can get it out, let's try to do it. Okay. And to the extent that you can be brief, that'd be great. Brief but thorough.
Brief but thorough. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Scott Nordstrand. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Civil Division of the Department of Law. I'm pleased to be here today on behalf of the Governor to introduce Senate Bill 132 relating to the Alaska State Commission for Human Rights. I will just overview the issues here, and we can talk about any particular areas that you'd like. This bill is designed to enhance the effectiveness of the Alaska State Commission for Human Rights by allowing the Commission to evaluate complaints of unlawful discrimination and allocate its resources to prosecuting those complaints that will best serve the Commission's goal of eliminating unlawful discrimination. It improves the Commission's procedures, it enhances the fairness of Commission procedures, it clarifies the remedies that the Commission may award to remedy unlawful discrimination, and does some housekeeping matters. I can go into the specifics, but I will say in general, the bill was designed to address the lack of prosecutorial discretion that the Human Rights Commission now has based upon an interpretation of its statute by the Alaska Supreme Court in the Meyer case. And basically what the Meyer case said was a finding of substantial evidence, which opens the door to further procedures before the Human Rights Commission up to and including a hearing. A finding of substantial evidence was at a level, I think, frankly, that a very short or very minimal evidentiary level. And the court concluded that that meant that the Human Rights Commission could not really exercise prosecutorial discretion. What this bill does is it adds to the statute provisions that will allow the commission to exercise prosecutorial discretion and dismiss claims that wouldn't be in the best interest of using state resources to go forward, so they can use their resources to better good in rooting out discrimination. That's in general what the bill does, and there are procedural aspects of this that make it more clear for those participants about what they're being charged with and why. There are a summary judgment procedure that's added here, so it's similar to the court system where these very same claims are adjudicated and summary judgment does apply. And then lastly, what we did on the remedies section was literally try to go through and list the kinds of remedies that are available to alleviate discrimination, but it's not an all-inclusive list, and we do leave the language in that says any appropriate relief may be awarded, but it then lists the types of relief so that folks who may not be represented by a lawyer could look at this and understand what kinds of remedies they could seek. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Representative Gruenberg.
Yes, we've been working on this in two committees now. And do you have that amendment?
Yes.
Okay. Do we have copies for everybody?
We have
plenty of copies. Okay. Here we go. Mr. Nor, and I'm going to offer this amendment here.
So that's amendment number one?
Sounds like a good starting point.
I'll object just for discussion purposes.
This is the only amendment I plan to offer in this bill. Well, we may talk about the other one, I'm not sure. But Mr. Nordstrand and I have talked. There are two kinds. We're looking at section four of the bill, pages 2 and 3. And the first kind of a dismissal is if there is not substantial evidence. The executive, and it's the bottom of page 2. The executive director must issue an order dismissing the complaint. But then the commission in its discretion may, and this we added in state affairs, but is not required to review the director's order of dismissal. And it may either affirm it or modify it or remand it or refer the thing back, not modify it, but affirm, remand, or refer the thing for conciliation. And that allows the complainant, for example, to seek a review of the director's dismissal. The director is the head of the staff. Okay,
The second, under sub B, says the director may dismiss without prejudice if the director makes one of a number of determinations. And this bill, as Representative Coghill may recall, was in State Affairs last year. And we worked a lot on it. And this list basically reflects, and the bill basically reflects the work we did last year. And it was very accurately done in that respect. I appreciate it. However, there is nothing in sub B that tracks the language in sub A that allows the person then to go to the commission and ask the commission to review. And that's what this amendment does. I just want to triple check. That's what the stuff on lines 10 to 17. Scott, what do the first three things do?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, essentially, if you look at the bottom of page 2 of the bill, where and line 27, where it starts with the commission, that's the discretion, the commission review section. What we did was we excised that from paren A, and then we created a new, that, and that's what the first few lines there do. We take it out of that, and then we created a new subsection C that allowed for that review for both A and B dismissals, and then we just moved subsection C to D.
And then what's this down at the bottom of page 3, line 22? What's that? To the chair.
B, line 22. Well, because we're not giving complete executive director's discretion anymore, so we had to take out, if no agreement is reached and the executive determines in the executive director's discretion to refer the complaint, now the power rests with the executive director, but subject to review. So we didn't want to suggest that it is just in the executive director's discretion, because it isn't.
That makes sense to me.
Just for a limit on time, sounds good. I remove my objection. You endorse it?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Further discussion on amendment number 1. An objection's been removed. Is there further objection to it? Okay, hearing none, amendment number 1 carries. I don't have anybody else that I know of. Is there anyone here in the audience to testify on Senate Bill 132 or anybody online? Okay, so hearing none, public testimony is closed on Senate Bill 132. It brings back
Madam Chair, Representative Grunberg.
Representative Grunberg.
Yeah, and Scott and I had talked about possibly another amendment, and I wanted to mention this to you. It's at the bottom of page 3, line 31. It allows the person to participate and file an answer and appear at the hearing and submit evidence, et cetera. It says, with or without counsel. And I wanted to be very clear that the law at the present time does not provide free counsel. And I thought that since a lot of this goes in pamphlets and stuff, we should let the people know that they don't have a right to a free attorney. Which I'd like to see them have, but they don't have it now. So it's going to have, with or without counsel, at their own expense. So there's no question about that. And that was my thought. I don't know.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, just so we're clear here, the person charged in the accusation, that would mean we're talking about not the complaining party, but the employer.
Oh.
So.
Oh,
I mean,
okay, sure.
I think, of course,
I would support that, too. Yeah.
So there is, and I should say that under current law, though never used as far as I can tell, in the statute, it does provide that the commission may order payment of reasonable expenses, including attorney's fees, to any private party before the commission when the commission, in its discretion, determines the allowance is appropriate.
And I won't offer the amendment.
Okay. Any further discussion or amendments?
Yes, no, Chair.
Representative Guerra.
Sorry, I'm going to work with you on moving this as fast as I can. There are substantial problems with this bill, just on a first glance, and I can go through them pretty quickly. And I'll do conceptual amendments as we go through.
Okay.
First is, it's been the law of this state and the law of this country that if you sexually harass somebody, that's discrimination. If you discriminate against somebody based on race or sex, that's discrimination. And if you do it once, it's still discrimination. That's why the laws always use discriminatory conduct. That's what's illegal. Now, everywhere in this bill, we've changed the word discriminatory conduct and said it's got to be a discriminatory practice before anybody can get any relief. I have very grave concerns that discriminatory practice means that it has to be an institutionalized repeat practice within the employment organization before a person is entitled to a discrimination claim. And so I'm going to move, unless you convince me otherwise, to change the word practice every place you put it in this bill and return it to conduct. Because let me give you the example. A supervisor grabs somebody's private parts, grabs somebody's breasts. I'm sorry, that's discrimination. That's sexual harassment. They do it once, it's still sexual harassment, even if it's not a long-standing practice. And I'm not going to pass a bill out of here. At least it's going to go over my objection if you tell me that the Human Rights Commission isn't going to regard that as serious conduct anymore.
Mr. Nordstrom?
If you could, we were just trying to conform the language to the language that describes in AS 1880-220, for example, unlawful employment practices. The language of the Act is written in terms of the word practice. That's why it was changed. It was not changed to change any intent of the law. It's one of those things that when, you know, the folks at the Department of Law are redrafting legislation and trying to fix things, we fix things to make them consistent with the rest of the statute. There is no intent. A single act would certainly constitute sufficient to give rise to a discrimination claim. But, you know, AS 1880-220 is unlawful employment practices. That's why we use that word.
Thank you. I apologize, Mr. Nordstrand, for being worried about this. I've done discrimination cases, and I worry that the term practice, and something tells me from back in my work on these cases, the practice can be interpreted as something that requires a course of conduct. And if you wouldn't mind a conceptual amendment somewhere in this bill in the appropriate place, stating that one occurrence can constitute a practice under this bill, then I think we're both on the same page.
I don't frankly know where we'd put that. Again, if you look at the statute, it already describes these as practices. In other words, what is being described here as being subject of the complaint, it has to refer to violating the rest of the statute, and the rest of the statute describes these things as unlawful employment and discrimination practices. So I think it would make it, you know, less clear is what I would. Unlawful financing practice, AS 1880-250. Unlawful practices in the sale and rental of real property, AS 18240. Unlawful practices in places of public accommodation, AS 18230. I think it makes sense for the violation to track what the actual description of the discriminatory practices are, and that's all we were trying to do.
I understand, Mr. Nordstrand, and we're on the same page. I'm going to offer a conceptual amendment that somewhere in the statute we define discriminatory practice to include a practice that involves one occurrence of that conduct.
Or more.
One or more.
Okay, so that's amendment number two. Conceptually, is there an objection?
I'll object.
Representative Anderson?
I'll object because this bill, House Bill 130, Senate Bill 132, and Mr. Nordstrom can correct me if I'm wrong, it relates to just what the title states, complaints and how they're filed, investigations, hearings. If you dabble, I think, if anything, you do the antithesis. Mr. Nordstrom stated that he's trying to be conforming in terms of the act of the practice of discrimination, and he says that rather than get into a debate on the word, he's using it and copying it from other aspects of human rights, I guess, codified law. If you were to change that and define it and say, well, hey, that's one touching, I almost think that should be in a different bill, I mean, than this one, to be honest, because then I think then you're getting into defining an act or a violation, and I don't think that's— maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think that's what this bill was intended. This is about the process.
If I could, and it, there's a difference between, it seems to me, conduct and practice in the sense of, if you look at the statute says it's an unlawful employment practice to, for an employer to refuse employment to a person based upon race, sex, religion, color, national origin. That's the practice. You refused employment. The conduct is essentially evidence of that practice. And so I just, we're talking, conduct is someone grabbed someone in an inappropriate way. If that's what the Representative Guerra is referring to, that's not what the statute says you can't do. What it says is you can't sexually harass, and that would constitute a practice that is illegal under the statute. And I know it's kind of a fine line, but it's important for us to make illegal or to provide consequences for what the statute says is an unlawful practice. And the conduct, it might be one act, it might be 50 acts that could be give rise to the unlawful practice itself. And that's the best I can explain it.
So, Madam Chair, just one more thing. So you're stating that practice encapsulates conduct. And so it's broader, and if anything, it makes the bill better. It's kind of the opposite of Representative Guerra seems to think, no, it undermines then someone if they grieve and say, hey, there was conduct, it was a touching one time versus two. Your point is, no, that would be under, presumably under the umbrella of practice, and it's covered anyway.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Nordstrand, would it weaken the bill in any way at all if we adopted that conceptual amendment? It would allow you to still, with my limited understanding and not having gone to law school, it seems to me it would allow the bill to still have the intent that we need it to have, but to take care of that concern, which if you were prosecuting every single case, I might not have that concern, but because this is open to interpretation broadly, it's a little different.
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, I think I would be very concerned about trying to define the word conduct in a specific way, that it's one thing or it's two things. It might, in fact, not be one thing. It might be not acting rather than acting. I mean, That's part of the problem with the word conduct that we were trying to get away from. Does conduct mean an overt act? Does it mean a failure to act? That's why we focused and refocused on practice. I think if you get into the business, I mean, I guess the best default would be we could go back to what we had and make it all say conduct again, and then it's ambiguous to me, and that's what we were trying to avoid. But if we actually say that practice means some particular thing, we'd have to go through all of these different sections on what is an unlawful practice, whether it be in housing or employment or in public accommodation, and we'd have to look at those things specifically and say, okay, what do you want to say is one time is enough? I mean, because these things aren't written, the statute isn't written in terms of actions. It's not written in terms of one act of something is unlawful. It says it's unlawful to discriminate. That means if you acted in such a way for these improper motives, and it's really about motives in a sense, not about the particular act, and that's what makes it hard to define that way. I think it could make a difference.
Just, and I think I would concur with Mr. Nordstrand's comment that I think it would be debilitating to the bill because you just made a comment. You said conduct. Are we talking overt or not overt? An employer asks an employee to go out. I don't think that would be good or bad depending on the reaction and the motive. And the employee says no, then the employer does nothing and ignores the, let's say, the employee, and that causes strife or problem in the employment. That's not an overt act. To me, maybe that's the opposite of an overt conduct. And I just think that we get into a hornet's nest if we change it.
Representative Gruenberg?
I'm going to withdraw the amendment. Fight over this. Though when you change words in a law, courts, when they're reading changes in the law, have a what they call a rule of construction. One of the rules of construction is that if you change words in a law, it's an indication that you meant something different than what you used to mean. I'm comfortable with what we used to mean. I'm a little bit uncomfortable, not a lot uncomfortable, but a little bit uncomfortable that if we change the law, that some defendant, some employer is going to come in and say they changed the word conduct to practice for a reason. And practice as it's used elsewhere means a continuing thing. If I were a betting person, I'd say Mr. Nordstrand's right. It's going to be interpreted properly. I think I would like to be more clear, but I'm not going to fight over this.
Are you a betting person? Do you support the card room bill?
Okay. Any further discussion? Representative Gruenberg?
By way of record, I have served as a hearing officer in a number of Human Rights Commission cases, four or five of them, a number of years ago. There are cases, I have a copy of the statutes, I mean the act here, and there's one case in particular, it's called French versus Jaden, and it was, the issue was whether there was a pervasive hostile work environment, and for the environment,
They looked at a whole series of things, the frequency of the discriminatory conduct, its severity, whether it's physically threatening, et cetera, et cetera. And so the term practice and then the use of the word conduct in these cases, we have a whole body of common law construing this act. And I really, before we did anything that upset that, I'd want to be very careful. And that's why we have not, and I think that the record is pretty clear, have not specifically really, in this committee anyway, relied on the one case, the Meyer case, dealing with this on a policy basis, because this is a very carefully crafted area of the law.
Further discussion on the bill?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think I have four other concerns. Let me run through them.
Okay.
Mr. Hartstrand, page 2, you're saying that you can't file a complaint for sexual harassment or discrimination, page 2, line 7, unless it's filed within 180 days. The normal statute of limitations for most cases is somewhere around 2 years, give or take some time. So what is it now under the Human Rights Act for the agency to bring an action?
It's 180 days, as defined by regulation under the Human Rights Act regulations.
All right, so the statute doesn't say anything?
That's absolutely correct.
Yeah, so I guess I'm a little uncomfortable saying that somebody has to complain that quickly in order for them to get help from the state.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, this is completely consistent with federal law. That's 180 days, the EEOC, and for a similar type of agency. This does not preclude an employee or any aggrieved person from bringing a Human Rights Act claim in court for up to 2 years. That still is a statute of limitations for 2 years in court. This just allows the agency to set a reasonable period of time after the discriminatory act for you to come to the agency for agency help, and it was simply, again, maybe we should not try to fix these things, but we thought it was not that appropriate for statute of limitations to be in a regulation, so we thought it should become part of the statute, and that's why we proposed this.
Representative Guerra?
And I think it was the statute is silent because I think there's probably some thought by some that the regular statute of limitations of 2 years would apply. And I would say I'm going to move an amendment number 3, to change 180 days to be 1 year. The reason is, you know, people are darned if they do, darned if they don't. If they sue, they're accused of being sue happy. If they don't sue quickly, they're accused of being too dilatory. And, you know, which is it? So I'm gonna move an amendment to give somebody up to a year to decide whether or not to seek state help.
I'll object.
Discussion? Did you guys discuss this, Representative?
No, we didn't. Madam Chair, is Paula Haley or anybody on the line? You don't have anybody from the commission on the line?
Representative Anderson. Sure,
and I know we have to move quick, but we have a thorough debate. I reject this only because the argument that, well, I respect your argument, but that you say, well, I think it hasn't been codified because the assumption is, you know, that it's interpreted that 2 years. I think that's our purview. We can codify anything we want. We're the policymakers. And, you know, half a year is fine to me. You know, 1/20th of a decade, I mean, however you want to look at it, that's a good enough time for someone to grieve in this case. I mean, this is about employers, too, because the employees aren't always right. I've worked in cases in law firms, too. In fact, I bet I've worked on, I won't say the attorney, but no, meaning that where I've had the opposite.
We've got to get going,
relative.
Though. I'm just saying. Where let's I've, try to confine
folks
our...
Folks have been complaining when it wasn't accurate.
Representative Coghill.
It was false. So... A lot of stories.
Has there been any persons that you're aware of, and maybe somebody who's worked as administrative law judge, that 180 days has aggrieved somebody to the point where they were not served well?
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, it's certainly possible that someone has missed that statute of limitations. I suspect over time someone has. I think there is a policy that. The overriding policy, I think, is with the sharing agreements between the Human Rights Commission and the EEOC, it makes sense for us to have the same statute of limitations for agency discrimination claims as the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And no one has complained about this.
I'm going to go ahead and recess to the call of the chair.
Thank you.